And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's May 20th, 140th day of the year. 225 days remain till the year's over with. This day in history, in the year 325 AD, the first Council of Nicaea is formally opened, starting the first ecumenical council of the Christian Church. And then this particular council, by majority vote, it was determined Jesus was the Son of God. Majority vote. 491, Empress Ariadne marries Anastasius I. The widow Augusta is able to choose her successor for the Byzantine throne after Zeno dies of dysentery. He was the late emperor. 685, the Battle of Dunetztain is fought between a Pictish army under King Bridei III and the invading Northumbrians under King Ecgfrith, who are decisively defeated. 794, while visiting the Royal Mercian Court at Salted Walls with a view to marrying Princess Ethelrith, King Ethelbert II of East Anglia is taken captive and beheaded. That's a nice wedding present. 1217, the Second Battle of Lincoln is fought near Lincoln, England, resulting in the defeat of Prince Louis of France by William Marshall, 1st Earl of Pembroke. 1293, King Sancho IV of Castile creates the Estudio de Escuelas de Generales in Alcalá de Henares. 1449, the Battle of Alfarabrera is fought, establishing the House of Braganza as a principal royal family of Portugal. 1497, John Cabot set sail from Bristol, England on his ship Matthew. He was looking for a route to the west. 1498, Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama discovers the sea route to India when he arrives in Kozhikode, previously known as Calcutta, in India. 1521, Ignatius of Loyola seriously wounded in the Battle of Pampeluna. 1570, cartographer Abraham Ortelius issues a Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, the first modern atlas. 1609, Shakespeare's sonnets first published in London, maybe illicitly by the publisher Thomas Thorpe. 1631, the city of Magdeburg in Germany is seized by forces of the Holy Roman Empire. Most of its inhabitants are put to the sword in one of the bloodiest incidents of the Thirty Years' War. 1645, Yangzhou's massacre. 10-day massacre of 800,000 residents of the city of Yangzhou, part of the transition from Ming to Qing. 1741, the Battle of Cartagena de Indias ends in a Spanish victory, and the British begin withdrawal towards Jamaica with substantial losses. 1775, the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, allegedly signed in Charlotte, North Carolina. One of my ancestors was actually part of that. 1802, by the law of May 20th, 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte reinstates slavery in the French colonies, revoking its abolition in the French Revolution. 1813, Napoleon Bonaparte leads his French troops into the Battle of Bautzen in Saxony, Germany, against the combined armies of Russia and Prussia. Battle ends the next day with a French victory. 1840, York Minster is badly damaged by fire. 1861, American Civil War. State of Kentucky proclaimed its neutrality, which will last till September 3rd when Confederate forces enter the state. Meanwhile, the state of North Carolina secedes from the Union. 1862, President Lincoln signs the Homestead Act into law, opening 84 million acres of public land to settlers. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of Ware Bottom Church, and the Virginia-Bermuda Hundred Campaign. 10,000 troops fight in this Confederate victory. 1873, Levi Strauss and Jacob Davis get a U.S. patent for blue jeans with copper rivets. 1875, signing of the Metre Convention by 17 nations, leading to the establishment of the International System of Units. 1882, the Triple Alliance between the German Empire, Austria-Hungary, and the Kingdom of Italy is formed. 1883, Krakatoa begins to erupt. The volcano explodes 3 months later, killing more than 36,000 people. True example of it can't happen to us. 1891, history of cinema. first public display of Thomas Edison's prototype kinetoscope. 1902, Cuba gains independence from the U.S. Thomas Estrada Palma becomes the country's first president. 1927, Treaty of Jeddah. U.K. recognizes the sovereignty of King Ibn Saud in the kingdoms of Hejaz and Najd, which later merged to become the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. 1932, Amelia Earhart takes off Newfoundland to begin the world's first solo nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean by a female pilot. She lands in Ireland the next day. 1940, the Holocaust. First prisoners arrive at a new concentration camp at Auschwitz. 1941, World War II, Battle of Crete. German paratroops invade Crete. 1948, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek wins the 1948 Republic of China presidential election, sworn in as the first president of the Republic of China at Nanjing. 1949, in the U.S., Armed Forces Security Agency, the predecessor of the National Security Agency, is established. 1956, in Operation Red Wing, the first U.S. airborne hydrogen bomb is dropped over Bikini Atoll in the Pacific Ocean. 1964, discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation by Robert Woodrow Wilson and Arno Penzias. 1967, the popular movement of the revolution political parties established in the Democratic Republic of Congo. 1969, the Battle of Hamburger Hill in Vietnam ends on this date. 1971, in the Chuknagar Massacre, Pakistani forces massacred thousands, mostly Bengali Hindus. 1980, in a referendum in Quebec, the population rejects by 60% of the vote a government proposal to move towards independence from Canada. 1983, first publication of the discovery of the HIV virus that causes AIDS takes place in the journal Science by Luc Montagnier. 1983, Church Street bombing, a car bomb planted by Umhoto Wesizwe explodes in Church Street in South Africa's capital, in Pretoria. Kills 19, injures 217. 1985, Radio Marti, part of the Voice of America service, begins broadcasting to Cuba. 1989, the Chinese authorities declare martial law in the face of pro-democracy demonstrations. Sets the scene for the Tiananmen Square massacre. 1990, first post-communist presidential and parliamentary elections are held in Romania. 1996, civil rights. The Supreme Court of the U.S. rules in Romer versus Evans against a law that would have prevented any city, town, or county in the state of Colorado from taking any legislative, executive, or judicial action to protect the rights of gays and lesbians. 2002, independence of East Timor is recognized by Portugal, yet formally ends 23 years of Indonesian rule and 3 years of provisional UN administration. Portugal itself is the former colonizer of East Timor until 1976. 2011, Mamata Banerjee is sworn in as chief minister of West Bengal. That's the first woman to hold that post. 2012, at least 27 people are killed and 50 others injured when a 6.0 magnitude earthquake strikes northern Italy. 2013, an EF5 tornado strikes Oklahoma City suburb of Moore, kills 24 and injures 377 others. 2016, the government of Singapore authorizes the controversial execution of convicted murderer Ko Jiabing for the murder of a Chinese construction worker, despite the international pleas for clemency, notably, from Amnesty International and the United Nations. 2019, International System of Units. The base units are redefined, making an international prototype of the kilogram obsolete. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Tiburcius and Helena. Alcuin of York. Aurea of Austria. Ostrogesilus. Baudilius. Bernardino of Siena. Evo of Chartres. Lucifer Cagliari. Sanctum. Day of Remembrance in Cambodia. Emancipation Day in Florida. European Maritime Day and European Council, Independence Restoration Day, that celebrates the independence of East Timor from Indonesia in 2002, Josephine Baker Day in the NAACP, National Waking Day in Indonesia, Indonesian Doctors Day in Indonesia, National Day in Cameroon, World Bee Day, and World Metrology Day. Well, let's see what else we've got. In 1293, an earthquake strikes Kamakura, Japan, kills 30,000 people. 1303, the Treaty of Paris restores Gascony to the English and arranges the marriages of English Prince Edward to French Princess Isabella. 1310 was when shoes were first made for both the right and the left feet. 1347, Rienzo calls Rome for a people's tribunal. 1495, French King Charles VIII leaves Naples. 1501, Portuguese explorer João de Nova Castelo discovers the Ascension Islands. 1524, the Duke of Albany leaves Scotland. 1571, Venice, Spain, and Pope Pius form the Anti-Turkish Saint League. 1639, in Dorchester, Massachusetts, the first school funded by local taxes is formed. 1690, England passes what they call the Act of Grace, forgiving followers of James II. 1774, the British passed the second of the Intolerable Acts, the Massachusetts Government Act, which gives British-appointed governor wide-ranging powers. 1825, Charles X becomes the King of France. 1830, the first railroad timetable published in the newspaper in the Baltimore American. 1830, D. Hyde patents the fountain pen. 1835 also is named the first modern king of Greece. 1845, HMS Erebus and HMS Terror with 134 men are to John Franklin sail from the River Thames in England, beginning a disastrous expedition to find a Northwest Passage. Everybody dies. 1861, the cornerstone University of Washington was laid in Seattle. Kentucky proclaims its neutrality in the Civil War in 1861. 1861, U.S. Marshals, in search of secessionist evidence, seized the previous year's telegraph dispatches. 1864, the Spotsylvania Campaign in the U.S. Civil War ends after 10,920 are killed or injured. 1867, Royal Albert Hall of Arts and Sciences Foundation is laid by Queen Victoria in London. 1882, the Gothard Rail Tunnel between Switzerland and Italy opens up. 1892, George Sampson patents the clothes dryer. 1895 was the first commercial movie performance. 1896, the six-ton chandelier of the Palais Garnier Opera House in Paris falls on the crowd. One person dies and a number of others are injured. And the lights went out. 1899, the first speeding infraction by a New York cab driver took place. He was driving an electric car and at the fast speed of 12 miles an hour down Lexington Street. 1903, Britain's House of Commons begins a debate on the charges of poor administration and ill treatment of natives in Belgium's colony in the Congo Free State. 1910, the funeral for Britain's King Edward VII took place in Westminster Abbey. Scott wanted the largest assemblages of European royalty in the recent past. '15, Batafish Petroleum begins oil extraction in Maracaibo. 1916, the Saturday Evening Post had a cover featuring Norman Rockwell painting. First time something like that took place. 1917, a Turkish government authorizes Jews to return to Tel Aviv and Jaffa. 1918, the first electrically propelled warship was launched to New Mexico. 1920, police raid the Cubs bleachers and arrest 24 fans for gambling on the game. 1920, Mexican President Venustiano Carranza, under attack by American petroleum companies, faces an armed rebellion by right-wing Sonora triumvirate after nationalizing subsoil rights. 1922, the Egypt sinks off Ushant after colliding with the Seine. 90 people die in that mishap. 1926, Congress passes the Air Commerce Act, requires the licensing of pilots and planes. Before that, it was catch-as-catch-can. 1926, the Railway Labor Act becomes law in the U.S. 1926, Thomas Edison says Americans prefer silent movies over talkies. On this day in 1927, at 7:40 in the morning, Charles Lindbergh takes off from New York to cross the Atlantic to Paris. He's flying the Spirit of St. Louis. This was the first nonstop flight in modern history. 1927, Saudi Arabia becomes independent of Great Britain in the Treaty of Jeddah. 1930, the first airplane was catapulted from a dirigible. It is flown by Charles Nicholson. 1930, University of California dedicated a massive $1,500 to research on prevention and cure of athlete's foot. 1939, the first regular transatlantic airmail. It was on Pan Am from New York to Marseille. 1940, German General Guderian's tanks reach the English Channel, cuts through the British Expeditionary Army. 1942, U.S. Navy permitted the first black recruits to serve. 1943, British, French, and U.S. Victory Parade takes place in Tunis and Tunisia. 1944, the U.S. Communist Party is dissolved. 1958, U.S. performs nuclear test at Eniwetok. It was atmospheric test. 1959, Ford wins a battle with Chrysler to call its new car the Falcon. It did not fly, in spite of rumors to the contrary. 1959, the Shah of Persia, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, visits the Netherlands. He was the last Shah of Iran, by the way. 1961, Mauritania adopts a constitution. 1963, Sukarno is appointed president of Indonesia. He was the first president. 1967, of 10,000 people demonstrated against the war in Vietnam. In 1969, I talked about the Battle of Hamburger Hill being over with. It was actually Hill 937, and after a long, drawn-out battle, we captured it. In 1970, 100,000 people marched in New York City supporting U.S. policies in Vietnam. In 1971, Pentagon reports blacks constitute 11% of U.S. soldiers in Southeast Asia. And finally, 1979, Elton John is the first U.S. Western pop star to tour USSR. And on that note, we're going to talk about the real War of the Worlds. Now, as I talked about yesterday, there's a lot more in the way of encounters between our military and UFOs than has ever been admitted. The author Nigel Watson wrote at length in his book UFOs of the First World War that so many explosions and DuPont factories making gunpowder for the Allied forces in such a short period of time and within such a small area, it was definitely very extraordinary. Now, you might assume that such accidents could result from the dangers endemic to munitions manufacture. However, the series of disasters that beset the gunpowder factories in the city of Philadelphia, which took place within 6 weeks and 4 days, which is literally unprecedented. Clearly, there was an outside force at work. Now, from World War I, let's turn our attention to UFOs in World War II. Now, Franklin D. Roosevelt, in a top-secret memorandum, dated February 22, 1944, wrote about the Special Committee on Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology is coming to grips with the reality our planet is not the only one harboring intelligent life in the universe. And there are times when you question if, in fact, there's intelligent life on this planet. September 1942, Albert Lancaster was on duty at Cresswell Radar Base near New Biggin by the Sea on England's northeast coast. Scanning the sky, the 27-year-old observer spotted a luminous sphere moving noiselessly behind a wispy cloud. As he was about to sound the alarm, the object shot down a foot-wide beam of bright yellow light that struck him in the face. He threw up his hands and said he felt a floating sensation before losing consciousness. Now, seconds or minutes, he wasn't ever sure. Later, he woke up unharmed a few yards from where he'd suddenly fallen asleep. That luminous sphere in the sky was gone, and he resumed his duties. He didn't report that incident and frankly forgot about it until he was into his 70s when he recollected having walked up a beam of light and been taken aboard a craft by a pygmy-sized man. Now, his brief capture was the only published account of its kind from World War II, but it occurred nearly 20 years before the Betty and Barney Hill incident, which is considered a classic UFO abduction case. 3 months before his abduction, a confrontation more typical of such encounters was experienced by Royal Air Force crew members. It was reported by Lieutenant Roman Ray Sabinski, serving with a division of Polish volunteers attached to the RAF. On the night of June 25, 1942, Sabinski was the commander of a twin-engine Vickers Wellington long-range medium bomber doing its return flight from a mission to Germany's Ruhr Valley. As he crossed the border over Holland, and the weather was very clear, his tail gunner alerted him of an approach to the stern by a very bright light. They thought it was an enemy fighter equipped with a searchlight. But as the interceptor gained on him, it didn't resemble an aircraft so much as an amorphous copper-colored spear. When it came within firing range, all four of the Wellingtons and Browning machine guns blazed streams of 303 caliber ammunition at the target. To the crew's surprise,
the rounds just entered the object and didn't come out the other side. The bullets were neither falling toward the ground nor passing through the object. They simply entered that ball of light and vanished. Remarkably, with so many apparent hits on the object, the crew could see no visible damage. In fact, they said it didn't have any effect whatsoever. As the tail gunner continued to fire, the spear suddenly changed position and at a terrific speed moved over to the port side, almost at the same distance, which is about 200 yards from the wing. Now the nose gunner opened up with his quartet of machine guns, catching the target in the crossfire that would have shredded any other aircraft, but it didn't have any effect on this thing. They ceased firing only when Sabinsky personally took over the controls to execute emergency evasive action. And while I was doing some violent maneuvers, he said, moving the wings up and down, this object stayed exactly at the extension of the wing, which means you'd have to, at that distance, develop tremendous speed to catch up and keep formation of my aircraft. Well, not even those violent maneuvers could shake off their unwelcome guests, the bomber's eight Brownings resumed firing. Again, they did not have any results. The spear then shot around and momentarily held a position directly in front of the nose gunner, who hit it with long streams of 7.7mm rounds at point-blank range. And then, after a few minutes of this, it took off at a fantastic speed, flying at least 45-degree angle, and just disappeared between the stars. After landing back at the base, he learned that a fellow Wellington commander participating in that same mission, flying some distance behind Sabinsky, had been identically confronted by the same kind of interceptor. On November 28 of that year, an Avro Lancaster heavy bomber of the 61st Squadron flew out of its base in Syreston, Lincolnshire, to raid the northern Italian city of Turin. After completing the target run around an exceptionally clear and bright midnight, every man aboard beheld a 200 to 300-foot-long object sporting four pairs of red lights spaced equal distance along that body. They watched that craft proceed on a course level with their own altitude at an estimated speed of 500 miles an hour, 10 to 15 miles southwest of Turin, and then it vanished. 5 minutes later, the object reappeared at 14,000 feet, cruising in a southwesterly direction just over the mountaintops of the Alps. Captain Lever remarked he'd seen similar craft 3 months before during operations over Amsterdam. Well, in a book entitled The UFO Files, Inside Story of Real-Life Sightings, British author David Clark describes a document relating to this incident in the Royal Air Force files at the National Archives. That document was stamped secret at the time, referring to 1942. It was judged to be of such significance that details were sent directly to the RAF Bomber Command with a covering letter from the Air Force, the Air Vice Marshal of No. 5 Group, which read herein a copy of a report received from a crew of a Lancaster after a raid on Turin. The crew refuses to be shaken from their story in the face of the usual banter and ridicule. September 10th, 1944, while the reconnaissance plane and its crew were returning from a mission over occupied Europe, on the English coast, possibly near Cranbury, their aircraft was approached by a metallic UFO that shadowed them. According to the August 5th, 2010 issue of Britain's Telegraph newspaper. Later, during discussions about the unexplained incident, the two men were claimed to have become so concerned by the incident, Churchill ordered it to remain secret for 50 years or more. For the previous 5 years, the British Prime Minister had occasionally received reports of sightings of unconventional aircraft made by his airmen, but had always dismissed them as a result of fatigue, fear, mistaken visions of the moon and stars, meteorological phenomena, or some other rational cause. This latest RAF encounter, though, was different. Photographs of the object, which the crew claimed had hovered noiselessly near the plane, were actually taken by the crew and submitted up the chain. Impressed by the visual evidence, Churchill immediately called together a secret meeting of scientists and military commanders to discuss the incident and similar ones that had preceded it. There were the usual speculations about Germany's advanced arms technology until a weapons expert dismissed the suggestions the object was a missile, as the event was totally beyond any imagined capabilities at that time. Of course, the flying saucers were real, according to Air Marshal Lord Hugh Dowding, Commander-in-Chief of the Royal Air Force Fighter Command. He said, they're interplanetary. More than 10,000 sightings have been reported, the majority of which can't be accounted for by any scientific explanation. He said, I'm convinced that these objects do exist, and they're not manufactured by any nation on Earth. I can therefore see no alternative to accepting the theory they come from some extraterrestrial source. Another person at that meeting, according to the Telegraph article, raised the possibility of a UFO, at which point Churchill ordered the report, together with the flight crew photographs of the object, to be classified for at least 50 years, and reviewed by the Prime Minister to stop panic spreading. This event should be immediately classified, he insisted, since it would create mass panic among the general population and destroy one's belief in the church. Now, I frankly don't know what the church has to do with anything, but that was Churchill's opinion. From September 17 to 19, Churchill conferred in Washington, D.C. with President Roosevelt, who'd already been briefed on the non-terrestrial science and technology several months before. After the visit, Churchill made the order suppressing public information about UFOs during a secret meeting with U.S. General Dwight Eisenhower, who was in commander of Allied forces at an undisclosed location in America. Churchill's recognition of unidentified flying objects was nothing new to Eisenhower. He'd already known about them for the previous 3 years. By the 1940s, UFO sightings and crashes had been reported across America. About 9 p.m. on April 12, 1941, Reverend William Guy Huffman Sr. was telephoned by local police concerning an airplane crash that happened at Cape Girardeau, a small Missouri city on the Mississippi River, about 150 miles southeast of St. Louis. Caller asked if the Baptist minister might be available immediately to administer last rites to dead and dying victims of the crash. As a neighbor drove up onto the disaster site of the farmer's field about 12 miles away, police and fire department assistance had already been dispatched. The crash might have involved a military aircraft nearby Harvey Parks Airport, which is about 30 miles to the south in Siskoton, where U.S. Army Air Corps flight cadets were in training. Accordingly, Cape County Sheriff Reuben Shade likely notified his brother Ben, a purchasing agent at Siskoton's Missouri Institute of Aeronautics, by telephone. And this would have certainly explained the appearance of Army personnel at the site shortly after Huffman arrived there. But what he saw was not a conventional aircraft, not by any means whatsoever. All right. What he found, Reverend Huffman, when he got there, was a badly damaged, shiny, silver disc, well under 100 feet across, surrounded by broken fragments reflecting the last moments of a contained blaze that had was being put out by the firefighters. Minister came closer. He found no propellers, struts, cables, or engine parts. But through a gaping space in the flickering light of the fire, he could see the sparse interior with some dials or buttons on a kind of control panel. There were three child-sized seats that had been removed earlier, apparently occupied by a trio of what he called little people. Somebody pulled the seats from the vessel and laid them out on the ground several yards from the crash. Two of the creatures were already dead, and the third, which was laying somewhat apart from the others, took a few shallow breaths before expiring in front of Huffman. They were all alike, no more than 4 feet in tall, gray wrinkled skin, thin elongated torsos and limbs, three fingers without nails, plus a long thumb on each hand. There were a pair of dots for nostrils, a horizontal slit for the mouth, and two huge black teardrop-shaped eyes on the otherwise featureless faces of the somewhat oversized heads. All this took place 25 years before the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case made gray aliens internationally known. A newspaper man posed and photographed one of the humanoid corpses between a pair of reporters. Group of Army personnel arrived to cordon off the crash site and confiscate all exposed film, personal notes, and souvenirs that folks might have picked up. Before their expulsion from the site, the two dozen or so civilians were sworn to lifelong secrecy in the name of national security. And, of course, there were the usually ensuing threats that took place. This took place at a time quite different from our own, when government authority was universally respected and an American's word was his or her bond. Soldiers returned to the Siskoton Army Air Base with the wrecked disc, all the debris, and the three cadavers. The next week, all the remains were transported to Washington, secured in a secret subterranean storage room beneath the basement level of the Capitol building. You have to wonder if they might still be there. Some months later, Secretary of State Cordell Hull escorted Turner Holt to the underground holding area. Thanks to Hull's influence, Holt had been appointed to an important advisory position in the Roosevelt administration. In consideration of his friend's recent promotion, plus Holt's celebrated reputation as a pastor of the Church of Christ,
all desired to get his reaction to the Missouri artifacts from a religious or spiritual man's point of view. On display was the crashed vehicle, plus its three former occupants. The little people are actually suspended each in its own glass jar of formaldehyde like frogs in a high school biology class. Bound by an oath pledging secrecy for the sake of national security, Holt broke his secret only to his wife and daughters, pledging them to say nothing about his particular visit with anybody. But he did urge him to go public with the story after he died because it was simply too important to history to just forget. Even after their father died in 1993, Holt's two daughters refrained from discussing his experience as long as their mother, Vina, who didn't even approve of such talk, was still alive. Not until April of 2009 did Aline and Lucille share their father's account with noted Canadian researcher Grant Cameron. Such a fantastic tale could easily be dismissed as a hoax, wouldn't it, for the indefatigable investigation of this case by Paul Blake Smith, who was himself a resident of the Cape Girardeau near the site of the 1941 crash. He supports his meticulous reconstruction of events with revealing source materials, such as a personal statement written in 1999 by retired CIA agency and U.S. Army counterintelligence officer Thomas Cantwell. He talked about an aerodyne, which was a generic term for a flying object, recovered in 1941. It crashed in the southwestern Missouri. Actually, it's southeastern, but you can forgive him his confusion. Cantwell's statement was underscored by a letter written in the early 1980s by theoretical physicist Edward Teller, known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, in which he mentioned 1939, 2 years before, a captured UFO, and this was talking about the Cape Girardeau event. He wrote about it to President Ronald Reagan. Earlier in September 1947, Air Force General Nathan Twining, assigned by President Truman to investigate UFOs, similarly referred to the recovery case of 1941. Now, the Cape Girardeau recovery didn't have near the national exposure of the Roswell crash, but still, it was an important event. During World War II, 10 months after the Missouri crash, President Roosevelt addressed the Army Chiefs of Staff in a confidential memorandum on the issue of finding out practical uses for the atomic secrets learned from the study of these celestial devices. 2 years later, in a double-top-secret White House memorandum for the Special Committee on Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology, he agreed that application of non-terrestrial know-how in atomic energy has to be used in perfecting superweapons of war to effect a complete defeat of Germany and Japan. In view of the cost already incurred in the atomic bomb program, it would at this time be difficult to approve without further support of the Treasury Department and the military. So I've decided to forego such an expense. Well, frankly, Roosevelt's Air Force scientists hadn't exactly failed to back-engineer the object retrieved from a Missouri farmer's field. U.S. physicists early recognized an atomic component in the Cape Girardeau specimen, and they strove to apply it somehow, if not by replicating the craft itself, by including some aspects of the technology in America's ongoing atomic bomb program. Roosevelt himself indicated that in his memorandum cited a little earlier in the show. According to Cantwell, the Army Air Force commanders hoped to introduce this craft, their duplication of the Missouri original, in war. But money resources just simply were not available. Funding wasn't available to R&D until 1946. The S-craft, as they call it, meaning saucer, could take off vertically and reach altitudes as high as 90,000 feet at supersonic speeds. The craft was so complicated that test pilots had great difficulty in high performance at very high altitudes. Several test pilots were killed as a result of decompression, and an ejection capsule or escape cylinders weren't designed for high-altitude ejections. As a result, one of the S-craft was lost completely. The materials used in the construction by Hughes Aircraft Company, failed to protect the test pilots in maximum throttle settings and exposed them to high-dose radiation. This, of course, resulted in serious illness and death. Test pilots continued over the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico in early 1947 at Kirtland Air Force, Army Air Force Base, and at Alamogordo Army Air Force Tularosa Range, with better results to flight performance, but exposure to the radiation from the atomic engine continued to be an issue. 1947, the S-craft is modified to carry atomic weapons over long distances, but high-altitude flight simulations and pilot survivability was still a problem. At least a dozen of these S-craft were built and test flown. Three were lost due to mechanical failure and pilot error. Two more
were lost along with 5 fatalities. They caused the Army Air Force to cancel the project indefinitely. But since when has our government ever canceled a project that even had minimal success? But what became of the alien wreckage and bodies at Secretary of State Hall and Pastor Holt saw deep beneath the Capitol building? According to Smith, my best guess is the materials were distributed among during late 1941 the following year to 3 different locales. First, scientist Dr. Vannevar Bush and the Scientific Research and Development Board apparently worked at some offices within Washington, D.C.'s Fort Belvoir, where George Marshall had some sway. So it appears that that's where the hardware was taken, scrutinized and photographed, and slowly synthesized and weaponized. Second, the legendary Wright Field, which became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, near Dayton, Ohio, had meteorology labs, aeronautical engineers, and developed more sites as World War II raged on to keep up with captured enemy aircraft. And third, the military air bases and labs, such as Sandia in New Mexico, like they got their hands on the technology. And it's replicated or reverse-engineered copies, some of which were tested in the desert, according to former Army CIC and CIA man Thomas Cantwell. Now, frankly, these are educated guesses. But no one could imagine FDR and Marshall hoarding the materials for more than a year in the bowels of the Capitol building. Once the heat wore off, so to speak, in the months after the crash, and there were no alien recriminations, they likely got that ET stuff out where they could start utilizing it for the war effort, especially after December 7th. America was in deep trouble in the early months and the years of the war, and every effort and resource had to be expended to dig us out of a major hole. Although MO-41, as the Cape Girardeau vehicle was called, may have vanished piecemeal between various Air Force bases, the crash was by no means the last one. According to General George C. Marshall, who was Chief of Staff, regarding the air raid over Los Angeles, we're talking about the Battle of Los Angeles here, this headquarters has come to the determination that the Mr. Airplanes are in fact not earthly and, according to secret intelligence sources, are on probability of interplanetary origin. Well, while President Roosevelt's scientists were struggling to transform the Cape Girardeau disk into an invincible wonder weapon, conventional Japanese warplanes wiped out the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor December 7, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. Over the weeks and months that followed, news went from bad to worse for the Americans as their forces were beaten into retreat across the vast Pacific theater. They had come into this war outmoded and poorly equipped, and they were paying the price. An unbroken string of defeats overseas engendered public anxiety at home, where even the West Coast was shelled with impunity by the deck gun crew of a Japanese submarine a few hundred yards off California's coast, about 10 miles down the coast from Santa Barbara. Well, FDR was droning on in a nationwide radio broadcast about the inequities of Imperial Japan. The Japanese submarine I-17 lobbed 5.5-inch shells at the Elwood oil fields. They destroyed a derrick and a pump house. Putting a bold face in her humiliation, Pentagon spokesman publicly ridiculed Kozo Nishino for the relatively minor damage he inflicted. The commander of that submarine had nevertheless landed 25 rounds on the mainland of the United States and then lazily cruised away after more than 20 minutes of firing. The 4th Interceptor Command, though aware of the sub's attack, according to Paul Collins in the Fate magazine article, ordered a blackout from Ventura to Goleta, but didn't send any planes out to sink that sub. Not one shot was fired at the sub. Unwillingness of American defenses to confront, much less interfere with, the submarine attack stressed already low civilian and military morale. Naturally, nobody was prepared for the events that started at about 3:16 in the morning on February 25, 1942. That's when 2 million residents of Los Angeles were jolted from their sleep by the eruption of every artillery piece in the metropolitan area, accompanied, of course, by the wailing choirs of air raid sirens. Total blackout went into immediate effect from L.A. to the Mexican border and inland to the San Joaquin Valley. Thousands of civil defense wardens grabbed their white helmets, and colossal luminous beams projected heavenward by more than 20 searchlights swept the clear night sky for enemy aircraft. Now, pilots assigned to the 4th Interceptor Command, which had recently refrained from going airborne against Commander Nishino's submarine, were similarly alerted, but once again told to stand down.
leaving protection of the entire urban area exclusively in the hands of flak gunners on the ground. They fired approximately 1,500 shells by 4:14 in the morning, though the all-clear wasn't sounded or the blackout order lifted till 7:21. Dawn revealed several buildings and vehicles damaged by shell fragments, and five people were dead of heart failure and automobile accidents amid the chaos and confusion. But there was less panic than exhilaration on the 4th of July type display. For all the excitement, no bombs had been dropped. No airplanes were shot down. At a press conference shortly afterwards, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox dismissed the event as a false alarm. Now, less than 3 months had passed since Pearl Harbor, resulting in frayed war nerves. Public relations officials for the United States Army Coast Artillery Association added that the shooting must have been triggered by some errant weather balloon mistaken for a Japanese bomber. Now, that conclusion, which was an off-the-cuff remark, would later be repeated by the U.S. Air Force Historical Research Agency, Ivory Tower Researches, don't you know? These statements were vigorously opposed by Lieutenant General John DeWitt in charge of the Army's Western Defense Command. He insisted the early morning blackout and anti-aircraft action had been triggered by unidentified targets sighted over the beach area. And he was supported in this assumption by squadron pilots of the 14th Interceptor Command, claiming they were ordered to man their planes and wait flight orders that never came. That's after unknown intruders were reported flying over the coastline. Now, in two official statements issued while Secretary Knox was attributing the alleged non-existent raid to Mastis Syria, senior officers of the U.S. Army Command in San Francisco confirmed and reconfirmed the presence of an unidentified aircraft over the Southland. Cannoneers at the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade affirmed that they'd begun firing 0.5 caliber machine gun bullets and 12.8-pound anti-aircraft shells into the air after sighting a solid target that they hit at least twice without any effect. Then their fire was joined by the 65th Coast Artillery Regiment in Inglewood and the 205th Artillery Regiment anti-aircraft based in Santa Monica. According to Bill Henry of the Los Angeles Times, overhead, silently, a glowing object was moving slowly as anti-aircraft batteries focused by spotlights began to take aim. He said, "That's far enough away to see the object without being able to identify it. I'd be willing to bet what shekels I have that there were a number of direct hits scored on that object to no apparent effect." Fellow Times reporter Marvin Miles described in his article, "Chilly throngs watched shells bursting in the sky, that the object in the sky slowly moved on, caught in the center of the lights like the hub of a bicycle wheel surrounded by gleaming spokes. That targeted object just inched along high, flanked by cherry red explosions." Los Angeles Herald Express staffer, according to Collins, said he was sure many shells hit it directly. He was amazed it hadn't been shot down. The object proceeded at a leisurely pace over the coastal cities between Santa Monica and Long Beach, taking about 30 minutes of actual flight time to move 20 miles, and then it disappeared from view. Now, Collins later wrote about this event. He said, "Eyewitness reports from thousands searching the skies with binoculars under the bright lights of the Coast Artillery verified the presence of one enormous, unidentifiable, indestructible object. A boy at the time, he and his family witnessed it, Ralph Blum, saw how the white, cigar-shaped object took several direct hits but continued on its eastward flight. There was another young witness who recalled that he, together with his mother and father, observed the entire episode through the large bay window of their home, which faced to the west. He said he remembered distinctly the convergence of searchlights reflecting off the bottom of some kind of slow-moving object, apparently flying in formation. They seemed to be completely oblivious and impervious to the shells exploding around them. I was quite the aviation buff back then," he said, "as I am now, but I must admit I had a devil time trying to identify these objects. We were looking through our window, the bay window in our room, which gave us an unobstructed panoramic view of the northwest, west, and east, southwest. We then went to our south-facing kitchen and porch windows to observe the action, where it culminated in the south. Ergo, the action followed the coastline. I strongly remember the searchlights converging on the bottoms of the reddish objects that were flying in formation. In fact, the Coast Artillery Colonel spotted 25 planes at 12,000 feet over Los Angeles.
Soon as the blackout went into effect, the information center was inundated with phone calls from patriotic citizens reporting enemy planes in the sky. The Army issued a War Department report that indicated between 1 and 5 unidentified objects had flown over Los Angeles. On second thought, embarrassed that American air and aircraft gunners could not shoot down slow-moving weather balloons at low altitude over nearly an hour, and afraid that such a public display of incompetence would further damage already depressed civilian morale, government authorities now gave out that the defenders of Los Angeles had been deceived by a meteorological phenomenon of some kind. Of course, they were emphatically contradicted by War Secretary Henry Stimson, who declared that approximately 15 planes had violated Southern California airspace. He knew, but he couldn't speak publicly about the state's still classified radar installations that had tracked unknown targets approaching from about 12,000 feet over the sea, 120 miles off the west coast on February 25th at about 2:15 in the morning. Within 4 minutes after the alarm was sounded, ground observers were reporting an enormous luminous object. According to Kevin Randall, a retired U.S. Army colonel and intelligence officer with a master's degree in military science, their sighting was confirmed by non-military witnesses using some binoculars. According to reporter Dirk Vanderplug, they observed a large orange object that moved slowly over the coast between Santa Monica and Long Beach. That object traveled to 20 miles in approximately 30 minutes and vanished. 8-year-old C. Scott Littleton resided with his family in Hermosa Beach, right on the beach. He said, "We had a grandstand seat. When my father went about his air raid warden duties, my late mother and I watched this glowing object that was caught in the glare of searchlights from both Palos Verdes and Malibu, Pacific, and Palisades. And surrounded by the puffs of ineffectual anti-aircraft fires, it slowly flew across the ocean from northwest to southeast. Headed inland over Redondo Beach, a couple of miles to the south of our vantage point, and eventually disappeared over the western edge of the Palos Verdes Hills, what's today called Rancho Palos Verdes. In any case, I don't recall seeing any truly discernible configuration, just a small, glowing, slightly lozenge-shaped blob of light. A single blob. We only saw one object, not several, as some witnesses later reported." Peter Jenkins, editor of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, said, "I could see clearly the V formation of about 25 silvery planes overhead moving slowly across the sky toward Long Beach." Police Chief J.H. McClellan, the police chief there, watched what was described as the second wave of planes from on top the seven-story tall Long Beach City Hall. An experienced Navy observer with powerful Carl Zeiss binoculars said he counted 9 planes in the cone of the searchlight. He said they were silver in color. During World War II, all Japanese aircraft wore camouflage colors. None were silver. This UFO group passed along from one battery of searchlights to another and under fire from several anti-aircraft guns. They flew from the direction of Redondo Beach and Inglewood on the land side of Fort MacArthur and continued toward Santa Ana and Huntington Beach. Anti-aircraft fire was so heavy we couldn't hear the motors of the planes. Well, in UFO Encyclopedia, author Jerome Clark recounts the testimony of an air raid warden who counted 6 to 9 luminous white dots in triangular formation visible to his northwest. The formation moved painfully slowly. Others moved very differently, though. The early lights were behaving strangely, Collins said to an eyewitness, quotes an eyewitness. They seemed to be navigating mostly on a level plane at that moment. That is, not rising up from the ground in an arc or trajectory in a straight line and then falling back to earth, but appearing from nowhere and then zigzagging from side to side. Some disappeared, not diminishing in brilliance or fading away gradually, but just vanished instantaneously into the night. Others remained pretty much on the same level, and we could only guess their elevation to be around 10,000 feet. But some of them dived earthward, only to rise again, mix and play tag with about 30 or 40 others, moving so fast they couldn't be counted accurately. Maybe the most compelling sighting made during the Battle of Los Angeles belonged to a young Hollywood interior decorator who gave only her first name. And that was Katie, living on the west side of L.A., not far from Santa Monica, where after the attack on Pearl Harbor, she volunteered to become an air raid warden. About 2:30 in the morning on February 25th, she was rung up by the district civil defense supervisor, notifying her about the alert. He also told her to keep a sharp lookout for an enemy warplane supposedly flying near her neighborhood. Well, she rushed to the window and gazed upward into the night, which was already alive with exploded shells and the crisscrossing beams of searchlights. And she spotted a single aircraft, she said. It was huge. It was just enormous. It's practically right over my house. Now, the cigar-shaped object appeared over Culver City and Santa Monica, both neighborhoods on the west side of town and closer to the Pacific Ocean. She said, I'd never seen anything like it in my life. It was just hovering there in the sky and hardly moving at all. It was a lovely pale orange and about the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. She said, I could see it perfectly because it was very close. It was big. They, the USAAC commanding officers, sent fighter planes up, and I watched them in groups approach it and then turn away. She said they were shooting at it, but it didn't seem to matter. She said, I'll never forget what a magnificent sight it was, just marvelous, and such a gorgeous color. Well, contrary to her observation, the 14th Fighter Squadron was supposedly grounded throughout the action. But her sighting was nevertheless seconded by Scott Littleton, who had watched it with his family as a strange object slowly moved out of view. And very quickly after that, he said, we saw a flight of planes following the track of that object going overhead, anywhere from 3 to 5 interceptors, clearly piston-driven UFO U.S. planes. Nobody's ever admitted that those planes were in the sky. A day later, in a CBS radio news broadcast, Byron Palmer reported U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark sky, but whether they contacted the object has never been announced. He said activity of the previous night had been observed by watchers on the hilltops of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood. Interestingly, Palmer was the first announcer in the broadcast history to use the term unidentified flying object. It must have been one that came to him naturally. In any case, federal government authorities clearly lied about the Battle of Los Angeles from its very beginning. Neither Katie's account nor that of any other eyewitness to the events of February 25th describe known weather balloons, meteorological phenomena, or even aircraft, ours or theirs or anybody else's. To be sure, 6 months later, Yokosuka E-14Y reconnaissance aircraft launched just off the Pacific Northwest coast by Japanese Navy submarine I-25 dropped 680 pounds of incendiaries on Oregon in two separate sorties, September 9th and September 29th, 1942. They were aimed at starting massive forest fires near the city of Brookings. And although the local woodlands are too damp from rains to catch fire, these two raids comprise the only bombing of the continental United States by aircraft during World War II that had been officially reported. Post-war examination of Japanese military records revealed that no such attacks or attempted missions were undertaken against the U.S. mainland before the Yokosuka seaplane flights over Oregon. A few hundred out of 9,000 free balloons armed with time bombs did crash across North America, but they weren't launched from Japan until 1944. Nevertheless, eyewitnesses on that night in February 1942 saw a silvery object resembling a balloon or blimp carrying red flares as it hovered over Santa Monica. Palmer himself observed the unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp. Many UFOs before and since have been described as oblong, cigar-shaped, tubular, resembling a dirigible or a blimp. Littleton similarly recalled, what captured our attention was a silverly, lozenge-shaped bug, as my mother later described it, whose bright glow was clearly visible in the searchlight beams that pinpointed it. And although it was a clear, moonlit night, no other details are visible, despite the fact that when we first saw it, the object was hanging motionless almost directly overhead. Now, you might keep in mind the Japanese operated no Zeppelins or blimps. Military powers everywhere long before discarded those as bombers following their unsuccessful performance during World War I. In any case, millions of observers of the unidentified object over L.A. that night did not see a conventional aircraft. So, what took place during the Battle of Los Angeles? Well, we've run out of time for tonight, and we'll finish up this story tomorrow. But once again, if you're listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show, until then, have a truly great evening.